Welcome to Voluntary Values on LRN FM. This is Daryl.
And this is Beverly.
And we are here live every Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. And if you are hearing us on the podcast or on a replay, you cannot call right now, but you can call Sundays 3 to 5 p.m.
Eastern Standard Time.
And if you're listening and you want to talk to us, give us a call at 603-435-1105. And we're going to start off this week talking about photojournalism and how that could possibly get you arrested.
Oh, yeah.
As a supposed suspected terrorist.
All right. So on the blog on the LAWeekly.com website, I found this article that talks about photographers can be detained as potential terrorists under official LAPD policy. So this was posted Wednesday, August 29th. All right, so the article says, even as America has remained fairly free of foreign terrorism in recent years, the LAPD this week moved ahead with an official policy that considers taking photos and videotaping of some buildings suspicious activity. Deputy Chief Michael Downing, who's in charge of the department's Counterterrorism and Special Operations Bureau, is drumming up support for the controversial policy changes by saying that there are terror cells active in LA right now.
Okay. I have a question here real quick, and I realize you're not the one to provide the answer, but maybe somebody with the LA Weekly might be listening, maybe. Probably
we can
not.
Dream.
Yeah, we can dream. Okay, it said the first sentence, it says, fairly free of foreign terrorism in recent years.
Yeah, fairly free. So
hold on. The last terrorist act by a foreign group on U.S. soil was 11 years ago.
Right. Almost exactly 11 years ago.
So what? You know, makes them say fairly free. Are they talking about the, you know, foiled plots drummed, you know, created by the FBI? Are they talking about
or maybe
where the guy got on the plane over in Europe somewhere?
Well, we did have that that colonel or major colonel or whatever he was out in
Texas.
Right,
but he wasn't foreign. He wasn't foreign. This says foreign terrorism.
Well, apparently he had links to Al Qaeda. Or the Taliban, whichever one, the terrorist links. And that's why he shot up everybody at Fort Hood. So maybe that's what they're referencing, fairly free.
Right. Well, I see the key word here as foreign terrorism.
Right.
And
I don't see American citizens
to be able to do foreign terrorism on U.S. soil.
Well, don't some... people within the government consider military bases to be foreign?
I believe somehow they're sovereign, but
I do think
foreign.
That they're sovereign, so they don't fall under the same laws that the rest of the land in America falls under,
right.
Except for the diplomatic, of course, the diplomatic people from other countries, because
right.
that's their soil technically, or the UN in New York.
Well, to some extent. The Native American Indian reservations are sovereign, but
right.
They're not considered foreign. Although I personally would love to see every Native American Indian tribe have its own country if it so chose to do so.
Yeah, me too. Me too. All right. So let's get back to this article. So KNX 1070 News Radio got this out of Deputy Chief Michael Downing. So he says, in this region, we have active terrorist plots in this region right now, said Deputy Chief Michael Downing, commanding officer of the LAPD's counterterrorism unit. The department is currently tracking government of Iran operatives. So government of Iran operatives, Hezbollah, sovereign citizens. There's another one, sovereign citizens. Homegrown violent extremists, animal rights groups, and others, Downing said. He added that Iranian or Hezbollah agents may initiate attacks locally if war erupts between the U.S. and Iran. If war erupts. Do you hear the
double? Like a volcano.
Do you hear the double speak in this, in
It's like a volcano. It's inevitable. It just happens.
Right. So we have no control over a war breaking out between the United States and Iran. None whatsoever.
Okay. Let's go back to who he lists as possible, terrorists. Okay. Iran, in my opinion, they pose...
It's Iran. If you want to say it right,
well,
say it's
technically
Iran.
Persia.
Technically, it is Persia.
Okay. So... the Persians and people from Persia, for the most part, there might be one or two crazy people in Persia that want to do harm.
For the most part,
the government of Iran or Persia or whatever you want to call that geographical landmass.
I'm the pronunciation police today.
They pose no threat to the American people.
No, and
Hezbollah poses no threat to America. In a dispute between, Israel, Palestine, right. They're up in Lebanon and Syria and the Palestine area.
Right.
They're fighting over there.
Well, technically there is no Palestine area since the Israelis have pretty much taken over all of Palestine. What was Palestine? I mean, the Palestinians are left with a very small
region,
sliver.
At one time was called the region. I'm talking about the actual region,
not historically,
a city state sort of thing. And actually, the word Palestine is like a translation of Philistia, which is where the Philistines used to live.
Ah.
So technically, if you go back far enough, there is no Palestine. It's Philistine. But... okay, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
Sovereign citizens. This is one that has always bugged me.
Yeah.
Because the definition of sovereign contradicts the definition of citizen. One cannot be both a sovereign and a citizen at the same time.
I agree. I've heard this argument before.
That's like saying that I'm a Afro-Caucasian American... Hindu foreign alien. Like, it just doesn't make any sense because everything contradicts itself.
Wow. I don't think I've ever heard it quite that way.
I don't even think I could repeat whatever it was that I just said. But anyway, so sovereign citizen, that's just a total contradiction of terms.
Right.
And I don't know if you've ever met any of the people that call themselves sovereign citizens.
They're kind of scary, if you want my opinion. I found them to be a little frightening.
I've not met any that were scary. I've met some that seemed very well-intentioned, but it just seemed so abstract of, we believe that we don't fall under any laws by any government, so we're going to file these papers with the government telling them that we don't fall under their laws, they're going to give us a piece of paper saying that. But we have to keep filing these papers because they keep changing what papers we have to file to say that we don't fall under this. Okay, then you're just like playing some weird little game with them.
Yeah, that's why I don't like the sovereign citizens, Well, first of all, it doesn't make any sense. And second of all, it's oxymoronic to declare yourself free from government and then go
beg permission
from the government. So, and here's probably my favorite one is the homegrown violent extremists. So what if you're not violent, but you're a homegrown extremist, but you're not violent?
Well, maybe it's kind of like what the Southern Poverty Law Center does, where...
oh, I love those guys.
They put out these groups called the Patriot List.
Right. I remember that list.
And they say inclusion on this list doesn't mean that you're violent, but people that listen to what you say are violent. Wait a second.
How does that make any sense?
That makes no sense. Well... talk about photography being a potential terrorist activity in just a couple moments here on Voluntary Values. listening to Voluntary Values on LRN. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly.
And we've been talking so far about photography being a potential terrorist activity, according to police in Los Angeles. And coming up at 3:30, we will have a very special guest, the author of Conscience of an Anarchist, Dr. Gary Chartier. He'll be talking about that book and the Vote for Nobody campaign. But right now we're going to go back talking about photography possibly being a crime in some places.
All right. So Deputy Chief, we were talking about Deputy Chief Michael Downing, who's the commanding officer for the LAPD's counterterrorism unit. And so the article goes on to say, while the suspicious photographer's policy approved by the police commission has some tight exclusive wording, we can imagine beat cops going off on everyday tourists or journalists as a result. The directive for potential criminal or non-criminal activity includes photography, taking pictures or videos of facilities, buildings, infrastructures, or protected sites in a manner that would arouse suspicion in a reasonable person. Examples include taking pictures or videos of ingress, egress, delivery locations, personnel performing security functions, e.g. patrol, badge, vehicle checking, security-related equipment, e.g. perimeter fencing, security cameras, etc. Observation/surveillance. Demonstrating unusual interest in facilities, buildings, infrastructure, or protected sites beyond mere causal.
Casual.
Casual. I'm sorry. missed that word. Casual or professional, e.g. engineer's interest, such that a reasonable person would consider the activity suspicious. Examples include observations through binoculars, taking notes, attempting to measure distances, etc. Wait, see something, say something, right? But not via binoculars or notepads, apparently.
Okay. I have questions.
Sure.
I've been to places where, you know, let's just say a bridge. And there's something that you want to look at from the bridge.
From the bridge, right.
Pretty much the only way to get a good view is through binoculars.
Right. So be careful. Be aware that if you're looking at, you know, anything through binoculars or, you know, with a camera, that you potentially you're a terrorist.
I've taken some really weird, somewhat artsy photographs before.
Right. I'm really glad that pre 9/11, I went out and did a lot of photography of buildings and stuff. Otherwise, if I did that today, I would be probably in Gitmo.
There are some very interesting buildings. And
you know, I agree. I love architecture.
If you take photographs of them, then you could be.
Oh, that reminds me of I was once watching.
Don't dare take a picture of a hydroelectric dam.
Right. Oh, don't you dare take a picture of one of those.
Hoover Dam. If you ever go to Las Vegas and
don't do it,
drive out to the Hoover Dam. Do not take photographs.
Don't even take your camera with you. So I was watching. I was watching a Law and Order episode of you know, the Special Victims Unit, the sexual crimes.
Oh yeah, only terrorists
one.
Do that.
And well, this comes with the territory of the photography. There was a woman who got raped in a building, and she blamed it on the guy that lived upstairs. And he had already been in trouble for taking photographs of what they thought was sexually suggestive photographs of a woman that lived across the street from him. When in actuality, the man was an engineer, and he was in love with bridges. He was fascinated by bridges, and he actually took a picture of a bridge, but he was labeled a sexual offender because the
bridges
in the
are
very
somewhat
corner,
phallic in certain designs.
No, in the corner of the bridge picture, the bridge was the majority of the picture. It just happened to catch a small part of the building that was in the frame. And just in the very corner of that was a woman who, with her window wide open, no curtains or anything. She was in the picture with her top off.
Okay.
So
let me just give advice real quick.
If you're not going to get in trouble for sexually provocative pictures, you can now be labeled a terrorist for taking pictures of buildings and bridges.
Let me just make some advice to anyone listening, male, female, whatever. If you're going to be naked in a room with your curtains open, you're just asking for people to take photographs of you because you are obviously exhibiting voyeuristic or that would actually be exhibitionist.
It wasn't
tendencies.
The woman who the woman in the photograph that actually turned him in. It was
she probably didn't know.
It was she more than likely she didn't know at all. She you know it was that when he went to get the pictures developed. Now, and this happened to me once, and so photography can get you into trouble. Just so you know, people, when my son was about 6 months old, I took pictures of him in the bathtub. Okay, in the bathtub. And we're talking, this is 1996. He was born in the end of 1995. So this is the spring of 1996, long before, you know, 9/11 ever happened. So I took pictures of him in the bathtub because he was so cute taking his first big boy bath. You know, he was so cute. And I was told that that was child pornography and they confiscated my pictures and would not take, once they started to develop them, they destroyed the pictures and told me if I ever brought pictures in like that again, that they would turn me over to Child Protective Services and I would go to jail.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is insane.
And I think they even turned him into CPS because like a week later, I had CPS at my door. You know, so, yeah. So be careful what you're taking pictures of, people. I know you shouldn't have to be, you know, we should be free to take pictures of whatever we want, whenever we want, however we want. Although I do disagree with child pornography. I think that's very wrong. But a mother taking pictures of her child in the bathtub where you don't even see I made sure not to take pictures of his little Willie.
Right.
You know, but still, just the fact that he was in the bathtub and didn't have a shirt on constituted child pornography. I think that's wrong. But, you know, whatever.
It's one of those things, and we discussed this briefly last week, where zero tolerance means zero common sense.
Right. And that's definitely another example of zero tolerance in effect.
Right. And tying in with the photography being, you know, potential terrorism. Apple
apparently has
patented a piece of technology which would allow government and police to block transmission of information, including video, photographs, or any other sort of recording that you could do with an Apple product. At public gatherings or venues that they deem to be sensitive or protected from externalities. And the event that comes to my mind just off the top of my head is the Occupy Oakland raid that happened in Oakland, California last year, where police actually blocked all major media from covering. And the only videos that existed were from people that were there.
Right.
That had video cameras and cell phones.
Right. So with Apple, and you know, Apple is probably a lot of people use Apple. I have an iPhone. I know lots and lots of people do have an iPhone. So this disturbs me very, very much so, since I'm paying a lot. I have paid a lot of money and I'm paying a lot of money for the use of my Apple product.
Coming up, we have Gary Chartier here on Voluntary Values. Welcome back to Voluntary Values. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly.
And joining us, we have a very special guest, the author of Conscience of an Anarchist. And is he the founder of the Vote for Nobody campaign?
No, he's not. That would be Brad Spangler.
Okay. But Gary is definitely involved with the Vote for Nobody campaign. Gary, welcome to the show.
Real pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. We're just really happy to have you on the show.
Yeah. Well, first off, tell us about the Vote for Nobody campaign.
So the Vote for Nobody campaign, as Emily just noted, is the brainchild of my friend and colleague from the Center for a Stateless Society, Brad Spangler. The Vote for Nobody campaign is designed to take advantage of the energy and enthusiasm and indeed hysteria surrounding the election campaign that's underway, and to use that as an educational opportunity to highlight the dangerousness and destructiveness of the state and to encourage people to opt out of statist politics.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions, and hopefully I'm not too rough on you. If I am, I do apologize, but I did promise that I would not go easy. So are you encouraging people to not vote?
My view, in brief, is that voting is most of the time a very ineffective way of achieving people's desired policy outcomes for a whole host of reasons. And that, in addition to that, it can be not voting can be both a useful educational exercise. It can give one a great opportunity to talk to people about the evils of the state, and at the same time, it can be a great way of not allowing yourself to be immersed in the craziness and hysteria and mindless team spirit that seems to arise during electoral seasons.
Okay, I would say that I probably agree with you as far with what you said. However, I don't really see the benefit of conscientious non-voting, just because there's no way to differentiate that from the apathetic non-voter. If for some reason or by some chance the system were to be changed to where if 50% of registered voters don't vote, then the results are invalidated, I would be out there, you know, cheering as loudly as possible, don't vote. Because then not voting actually would change something. But the way the system is set up now, if one person goes to the polls, somebody still gets elected.
Well, that's the whole point of this campaign, though, is to educate people, Daryl, about the reasons why they shouldn't vote. That nobody's going to be able to change anything. No politician is going to be able to do anything for you that you cannot do for yourself.
And I agree, but you know, like I said, I don't see, you know, a actual difference between. As far, you know, in actually making a change of policy, there is no actual difference between the conscientious non-voter and the apathetic non-voter.
Well, does it really make a difference, though?
I want Gary's opinion on this. Gary, what do you believe on that?
Sure. So I guess I think you're exactly right that it's not going to make a policy difference for just the same reason that that voting isn't going to make a policy difference. I do think it's not just the simple fact of deliberately choosing not to vote that makes a difference. It's taking advantage of that as an opportunity for education. If you choose to do that, if you walk around with your little sticker that says not, I voted, have you, but rather I managed to avoid voting, have you, and you do what some people were talking in the chat on Friday about the Vote for Nobody campaign. We're talking about doing participating, say, in tabling events that candidates and campaigns are involved in, but instead using that to talk about not voting. I think that's a different matter. Then that creates some educational opportunities that that I think are valuable. But the sheer fact of not showing up for the polls isn't going to impact policy. That's right, and I don't think that's the purpose.
Well, what's your opinion of voting for NOTA?
I think if you have a system that that enables you to vote for NOTA, that would allow NOTA to be chosen in preference to any actual politician, I think that would be a great thing, and I'd probably encourage people to do that, because the goal is precisely to disempower and delegitimize the state,
right.
And clearly voting for NOTA could have that effect.
I agree that, yeah, if you do have the option to vote NOTA, then, you know, that's a perfectly valid. And if I was still voting, that's what I would write in for everything is NOTA, none of the above. Because for those of you who don't know what NOTA means, it's none of the above. You know, because voting is just wrong. And it doesn't really make a difference if you vote or not.
Right. And there are the people that say, you know, if you vote, then you're, you know, somehow validating the system. And I know in Conscience of an Anarchist, Gary writes on this and actually says that there's no way to actually say that you are validating the system by casting a ballot. And Spooner actually writes on this saying, you know, that voting does not necessarily consent. Gary, would you go into some details and explain your thoughts on that?
Sure. So it seems to me that people obviously can choose to participate in the electoral system on the view that what they're doing is really trying to prevent bad things from happening. They're trying to defend themselves and others against the aggression of the state, and they're seeking to make a difference that way. And I don't have any burden to be self-righteously condemnatory of those people. I'm just increasingly skeptical that there's any likely outcome that they're going to be pleased with. I don't think we see any evidence of that in large-scale elections that I can point to. And I also think that there are reasons why you might well benefit from not voting. So I'm not arguing for some kind of moral condemnation of people who vote. I'm arguing that there are moral reasons you might choose not to, even if they're not necessarily decisive, and there are very practical reasons why you might well want to avoid the practice of voting. I think Spooner's right that people who vote defensively to make the state's impositions on them less onerous can hardly be said to be, in so doing, consenting to whatever impositions they are subjected to. I would just add that I'm doubtful in most cases that how I vote is going to have any impact on the level of imposition on me.
Right. And I believe it's Robert Nozick who wrote The Tale of the Slave actually writes about that, to where it starts off saying that you're one of 10,000 slaves, and the master basically controls you. And throughout several processes, you actually get to vote to, like, change the master's mind or change policy. And then it said, at what point did this become anything other than a tale of a slave? Right. So I do agree that, you know, there's not a lot of benefit to voting. However, you know, in the given system that we have, it's really the only way to express your opinion of any policy or person making policy.
I tend to disagree with that, Daryl, that voting is the only way that you can express your disapproval of a policy or of a person. There are many other ways to communicate that besides voting.
True. And we'll finish discussing this when we come back here on Voluntary Values. And Gary, we hope that you will stay with us.
Oh, will do.
All right, we'll be back momentarily on Voluntary Values. Welcome back to Voluntary Values. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly.
And we're talking with Gary Chartier, the author of Conscience of an Anarchist. And we've been talking about that book as well as the Vote for Nobody campaign. So, Gary, for anyone that is just joining, can you please give a recap of just real briefly what the Vote for Nobody campaign is?
Sure. The Vote for Nobody campaign is an educational effort designed to encourage people to opt out of statist politics and use the fact that they're opting out as a chance to talk to people about alternatives to rule by the state.
Okay. And we have a caller on the line that has a question for Gary. Ian Freeman, one of the co-hosts of Free Talk Live, is joining us now. Ian, you're on the line.
Hi, Gary. Where are you in the U.S.?
I'm in Riverside County, California, a little south of L.A.
Oh, okay. No wonder you're so frustrated. I totally understand where you're coming from. When I moved up to New Hampshire as part of the Free State Project, I was pretty burnt out on the whole political system, too, and I would have been very appreciative of your message. But what I found was that in New Hampshire, votes actually do make a difference because there's 400 state legislators, and it's relatively easy to run political campaigns up here. The Free State Project already has over a dozen members that have been elected to the legislature, and they've introduced pro-liberty legislation and that sort of thing. So I don't think it's true that across the board that voting is useless. It is a method to affect the existing system, and I think that the folks that want to opt out of voting, I don't blame them for that, but they kind of pretend like it's activism to not vote, and really it doesn't affect anything because if people don't show up at the polls, the government keeps doing what they've been doing. There have been voting days where 0% has turned out, and the government doesn't take that as a message to go home. They keep coming, and they keep doing their aggression. So really, ultimately, what people should do if they really want to do something effective is stop cooperating, stop obeying, and stop paying the taxes.
So I think, as you all have gathered in from what I had to say earlier, and certainly if you've read my book, you'll see that I say the same thing there, I have no dogmatic argument to make against people who find that in a particular situation, choosing to participate in electoral politics is effective. The claim that I made was a lot narrower than that, namely that I think as a general rule, I'm disinclined to think that people can achieve the policy outcomes they want to achieve by voting, and that there may well be advantages to sticking oneself out of the electoral process. I'm not arguing that in a case where it is obvious that you can make a difference, that you should ignore that opportunity.
That's cool, and I appreciate that because there certainly are some dogmatic folks out there. I mean, it sounded like Emberly said voting is wrong or something like that, which doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I do believe that, voting is, it's wrong for me. It may not be wrong for everyone else, but I just completely disagree with voting in a new master. I just don't think
so
that you have
vote
to
for Daryl then because he's running for a political office.
Well, it wouldn't. No, I wouldn't vote for Daryl. And I straight up told him that when he asked me, to help him with his campaign, I was like, well, don't expect me to vote for you because I won't. Even if I lived in Keene, I still wouldn't because I don't actually live in the county to vote for him. But I wouldn't anyway.
Gotcha.
And that's my conscience. I mean, I have to do what's right for me, and everyone has to do what's right for them. And it's like I've stated before, you have to do what's what you feel comfortable with, how you feel comfortable in your activism.
So if Daryl makes you uncomfortable, you think that, he gets the ring of power and then he's going to wield it on people, right?
I don't. that's really a great way to put it. But I don't think that Daryl's going to try to wield the ring of power over my life. But I know that there are politicians that will do that. And,
I
just
don't.
How is
voting for him then a problem? I mean, what's immoral about it, I guess, is what I want to know.
Well, for me, it's immoral because I don't believe that I need anyone to tell me how to live my life. At all. I own myself. I don't need a politician to tell me that I can't do anything.
You need a politician to tell you how to live your life? Is that what voting means?
To me, that's what it means. Voting to me means that you're giving permission to someone else to tell you how to live your life and what rules and regulations you can be governed by.
Even if that person is specifically running on a platform of, I'd like to eliminate my own office position. Isn't that your position, Daryl?
Yes, if elected, I will lobby the state legislators to abolish the position.
And that's a worthy goal, and I like the fact that Daryl is doing that. It's just not the right move for me, personally.
Gotcha. So it's more of a feeling rather than a logical thing.
Well, for me, it is. It makes sense for my life. It's logically right for me. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's logically right for anyone else.
Okay.
And I have a copy of Gary's book, Conscience of an Anarchist, right in front of me. And I'm trying to find where Gary actually writes in here.
Well, I talk about this. It's in the last chapter.
The last chapter.
Yeah. I'm talking about different strategies for moving beyond rule by the state.
Right.
And I devote a couple of pages to discussing the possibility of electoral strategy.
Ian, did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
I think that's great. Thanks, guys.
All right.
Thanks, Ian.
Cool. Thanks, Ian. Okay. So while I look for this, Gary, if you just want to summarize what you actually wrote in here about, I believe, something about a dictator takes over and allows the village to vote for one of his two sons, and one is less dictatorial than the other?
Yeah, so, okay, so you're thinking of actually it's a somewhat different place in the book than I think than what I was thinking of a second ago. Right, so what I'm thinking about there is a slightly different issue, which is the issue of whether consent to the state can be inferred from voting. So, as you know, the official ideology of democratic states for the past, say, 300 years has been that the authority of the state rests on the consent of the governed. And the real difficulty has been to actually show that the governed have consented, because there's no evidence that you have or that I have or that Amberlee has or that Ian has. And this frustrates those who sit at the pinnacle of power, because mm-hmm. their sense of legitimacy and their ability to defend that legitimacy depends on this. So one of the, you know, they try to come up with various proxies for consent, right? So the silliest is, well, if you just stay put and you don't leave the territory of the state, you must consent to its rule, which, of course, is ridiculous, because that presupposes what's at issue, namely that the state is entitled to rule this territory in the first place. And so, you know, then they try other strategies, and one of them is, well, if you vote, you must be consenting to the authority of the state. You must be accepting the legitimacy of whatever outcomes emerge from that electoral process. And the example that you're talking about is one in which, right, I'm given the choice between two thugs, one of whom I judge to be slightly less dangerous than another. Well, if I do choose to vote for the thug I see as less dangerous, that hardly means I'm consenting to the whole system of rule by thugs. That's what I was getting at there, that you can't somehow deduce the legitimacy of the state or the acceptability of its authority as if I somehow consented to that authority by engaging in that kind of defensive voting of the kind that Spooner talked about.
Right. Now, I tend to agree with you, and I think that's basically the point that Ian was making, of realizing there will be an election. Somebody will get elected to an office, whether you want them to or not. So, and I do not advocate voting for the lesser evil at all.
Which is one of the reasons why I don't vote.
Otherwise, I would not have written in my book, Duopoly, How the Republicrats Control the Electoral Process. I would not have written Operation Spoil the Vote and advocate voting for NOTA if I supported voting for the lesser evil.
Sure.
So, you know, I think that's one thing that a lot of people, they just don't really want to accept, that there will be an election and somebody will get elected. So, you know, at least, you know,
well, Daryl,
state,
you know,
your preference.
I do understand that, you know, there's going to be an election whether I go to the polling station and cast my, you know, my ballot or not. However, to me, I have better things to do than go tell these people, you know, than to tell these people exactly, you know, who I like better. You know, it's a popularity contest, in my opinion. You know, and so I don't want to, and this is a relatively new thing for me, because I was heavily involved in electoral politics for many years. So this is a new thing for me. Gary, would you mind holding on for another segment, or do you need to go?
Sure.
We actually have two callers on the line, so as soon as we come back after the top of the hour news,
fantastic,
we will be rejoined by Gary Chartier on Voluntary Values.
I'll be there.
This is hour two, the final hour of Voluntary Values here on LRN. This is Daryl.
And this is Amberlee.
And we have a very special guest on the line. He's been on the line for the last half hour, and hopefully he'll stay on with us.
Dr. Gary Chartier, are you still there?
I sure am, Emberly.
Yay!
Great to be here.
All right. And, Gary, we actually have what appears to be a Christmas tree in front of me, but it is actually callers on the line. They want to talk to you, Gary. So
awesome.
Great, I'm here.
All right. We have Nicholas. You are on the line with Daryl, Emberly, and Gary Chartier. What's on your mind?
One. This is Nick Ford.
Hey, Nick.
Just
great
wanted
to hear your voice.
Hey, good to hear from you, Gary. And I just kind of wanted to briefly talk about the Vote for Nobody campaign in general, if that's okay.
Sure. Fine with me.
So one of the aspects of the Vote for Nobody campaign is to have certain groups being formed in certain states so that we can actually prove that not voting is an actual strategy. It's an actual thing that people engage with, and it's not the same thing as sitting at home and not doing anything or anything like that. So what I'm trying to do is, especially because of the recent so-called debacle at the RNC with Ron Paul getting his delegates taken and all that kind of stuff, I feel that, especially in New Hampshire with the Free State Project and a lot of voluntarists and agorists and people like that who aren't necessarily as interested in voting as other people are, that it would be a good place to have something like a Vote for Nobody campaign actually in New Hampshire. So what I've begun to do is to start to reach out to people who might be interested in that and see whether they want to, set up tables at political events and tell people about the Vote for Nobody campaign and radical alternatives to voting and all that kind of stuff. So that's something I'm trying to do right now. And really glad you guys could have Gary on. I only managed to get through a few chapters here and there of Gary's book, but it was really, really well done, and a big fan of a lot of Gary's work.
And, you know, Nick, thanks so much for those kind words about the book, and, congratulations on the hustling you're engaged in. I think, the activities that you're highlighting in New Hampshire and elsewhere are the kinds of things that I had in mind in my talk on Friday and, in the essay that I've written about this. If you're going to not vote, then you need to take advantage of that as an opportunity for education, because otherwise, I think Daryl's absolutely right, if you're just not voting and sitting at home out of apathy versus not voting and sitting at home out of some disgust at the political process, nobody can tell the difference. But if you use this as an opportunity for education in the way that you're doing, then it seems to me that that's a way in which not voting can turn out to be quite educational and provocative.
Right. And I think another thing to point out is the Vote for Nobody campaign isn't about making policy changes, at least for me personally. The Vote for Nobody campaign is all about bottom-up social change through communities and through working together with other people and mutual benefits and cooperation and stuff like that. It's not about seeking change through the top down, and it's not about seeking change through voting or anything like that. I'm not so much interested in some of the debates about it, whether it legitimizes the system or whether it doesn't. I think that the Vote for Nobody campaign is pretty much united in some sense or another, either in some part de-emphasizing the need for voting or the idea that we should vote as libertarians or anarchists or whatever you want to say, or just a total refusal of voting. So I think there's a spectrum of people in there. Some people use the moral arguments, some people use the practical arguments. For me personally, I like to rely more on the practical stuff, and then voting for me is a pretty morally nebulous concept, and it's so morally nebulous, at least in my position, that I wouldn't feel comfortable voting, even if it had some sort of practical benefit. I'd rather do bottom-up community organizing or do something like that, mutual aid societies and stuff like that. So I'd much rather do bottom-up social change anyway, even if voting had some sort of practical use. My reasoning for that is that if somehow we could actually get the somehow could actually get the ruling class to listen to us and get the population actually somehow motivated enough to implement policy change, well, then I think we have enough people to actually do way more powerful social change from the bottom up than from the top down. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. And I would like it if people would get in touch with me on, like, Facebook or whatever, because really trying to get this organized a bit so we can table at places and get the word out about that people should vote for nobody.
Anything else you'd like to add, Nick?
No, I think that was about it. I wish I had a question for Gary, but that was mostly what I wanted to say. But I really appreciate a lot of what Gary does, and I
awesome.
Think he just does awesome, awesome work.
Thanks,
thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. So, Gary, something that Nick had touched on and was saying that, you know, in a lot of cases, voting does not, you know, bring about any kind of change. I'm not sure what system every town across the country has, but I know that there are towns in New Hampshire, the small town with, you know, small populations, they don't have the city council. They don't have, you know, a mayor. They don't have a town council. They have what's called town meetings. So that anyone in the town who attends the meeting then gets to vote on policy for the town, such as implementing or removing zoning. They vote on the town budget and other things like that. So that there are some cases where, you know, you actually can bring about change in voting. And I'm sure you would agree in cases like that, go ahead and try to make that change. Am I putting words in your mouth, or is that something that you would support?
Okay, Daryl. So I think that's a really helpful example, right? I mean, so we can certainly imagine a case in which there's a population of only three people voting. You're one of those people. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, it's hard not to say in that case that if you really think you can do something to prevent, bad stuff from happening, am I going to condemn you for that? Of course not. And I think, again, Spooner's point about voting defensively, not legitimating the state, is applicable here. You're certainly not legitimating the oppressive system that the voting's taking place in the context of, right? I mean, I don't, when you have a town meeting like that, I still don't grant that the folks assembled there have the authority to make zoning decisions in the first place. That's not their business. But given that they are making those decisions, if you have an ability by participating to limit that the reach of those obnoxious zoning decisions, great. I'm certainly not condemning anybody for doing that. The Vote for Nobody campaign, as I've chosen to participate in it, is not about looking for opportunities to beat up on people who make alternate choices. It's simply noting that there are some great opportunities for education and social action that obtain when we say no to involvement in an essentially corrupt and destructive process. If somebody says, no, I'm going to be involved on a defensive basis in this process, I have nothing bad to say to that person. I just want to say, understand why I'm doing something different.
Right. And, you know, I completely agree where you're coming from, and like I said, you know, on a lot of things I actually agree with you. However, mm-hmm. on election day I will still go grab a ballot, and for almost every office I will be writing in none of the above.
I'll be holding my Vote for Nobody sign.
Gary, will you hold with us at least one more time?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you. We'll be back momentarily on Voluntary Values. Welcome back to Voluntary Values on the Liberty Radio Network, online at lrn.fm. And if you are online, you can look at the webcam and see our lovely smiling faces. And give us a call at 603-435-1105, especially if you have a question for Gary Chartier, our guest. He's on talking about the Vote for Nobody campaign and also about his book, The Conscience of an Anarchist. And Gary, I love what you're doing with the proceeds from the sale of this book.
Me too.
Tell everybody what you're doing with the royalties or proceeds that you get from the sale of your book.
So any royalty that comes in from the sale of the book is designated for use by our friends at antiwar.com. And that's a cause I really believe in. I think, as I've said in a number of contexts, there's war and then there's everything else. War is by far the worst thing the state does for all kinds of reasons. And I think trying to do something about that, trying to educate and mobilize in the way that antiwar.com does, I think that's a great thing. And I really welcome the opportunity to support the program.
And I know that they're happy to have your support. I'm sure you've
exactly
put large amounts of money into their coffers so that they can continue to do the great job that they do. It's just a shame that they had to get rid of anti-war radio because donations have sort of
so
dwindled.
The things are so tight financially there because what Scott does and the fact that Scott is continuing to keep that program going on his own is just a real testament to his commitment to make a difference. But the fact that antiwar.com couldn't continue to support that is so dismaying, and I just hope we can all pitch in, help out there, and help to ensure that programming like that can indeed be available courtesy of antiwar.com, which is such an invaluable resource.
Yeah, I've been a monthly supporter for a couple of years now, and I've actually had the pleasure of meeting Angela Keaton on numerous occasions. She is a wonderful woman, and she just does great work over there at antiwar.com. But let's get back to talking about the Vote for Nobody campaign. And Emberly just put me onto the Learn More page.
Well, first, let's give out the website.
Over at antipolitics.ws. That's antipolitics with a dash between anti and politics. And WS... I don't know if Gary would know this.
No, that'd be something we'd have to ask Brad about.
Okay.
Yeah, I would encourage getting Brad on the program. I'm sure he'd be glad to talk about that, but I can't answer the question.
Okay. I just didn't know if you knew, because I know a lot of times there's a reason, like the .tv, TV station, although it's actually the top level domain for Tuvalu.
Right.
WS is actually the top-level domain for Samoa, which used to be Western Samoa. But I'm just curious why that domain was chosen. But any listener can go to the website, anti-politics.ws. So I'm reading through the Learn More, and one of the questions on here, and it's something that I asked you, and I really like the answer that's given on here. Should I abstain from voting or actually go to the polls and write in nobody? And the answer provided on the website is that's a personal decision.
And that's where I agree as well, is that voting is a personal decision that you have to make for yourself, whether you think it's right or wrong, moral or immoral, however, whatever words you want to cloak it in, that for me, it's not the right thing to do, but for you, it might be.
Right. And as I've said before, if there was some way to have some kind of legislation saying if less than X percent went out to the polls and voted, then the results are invalid. I remember when I was living in San Antonio last year, they had a mayoral election. 7% of voters in San Antonio went to the polls. And it wasn't reported that way in the media. It was just reported that the mayor was elected by a landslide with 81%.
Well, 81% of 7%.
81% of 7% means 95% of the people did not want him reelected. But it wasn't reported that way. And, I guess that's where I'm coming from with having the hard time differentiating.
Daryl, I think that's why the Vote for Nobody campaign exists, is to, you know, to show people that it really doesn't. I mean, the turning point for me was in 2000 with voting, when, you know, when we went to vote for the presidential election, and then our votes were basically thrown out the window and said, we don't really care. The Supreme Court will decide who's going to be president.
Right.
You know, and that for me was the beginning of the end of voting for me.
Well, and the Supreme Court actually did not decide who would be president. The Supreme Court decided whether or not Florida would continue their recount past the deadline that Florida had set for when votes had to be certified.
Okay, technical man.
But the practical effect, and I'm sure the politically motivated effect, was to stop the process of counting so there wouldn't be an accurate count of the votes. That, I think, is the important thing, and that happens repeatedly. You know, I've been reading, I mentioned this on Friday in the talk that that Emberly checked into at Vote for Nobody. I've been reading through Robert Caro's masterful biography, multi-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson, The Years of Lyndon Johnson, which is just a striking, striking study in the way in which power is acquired and used in the political process. And the second volume of that multi-volume work focuses on the 1940s, and it ends in 1948 with a primary vote for a Senate seat in Texas, a Democratic primary vote. And the contest, a statewide vote in Texas at a time when winning the Democratic primary was tantamount to winning the general election. There was no chance, if you were a Republican in Texas at that point, to go anywhere. The statewide election with many, many votes participating ended up being, quote, won by candidate Johnson by 87 votes. And it was apparent that there had been a tremendous amount of mischief-making going on. And in one county, in Duval County in particular, there were 200 votes that were in question. Somebody who had seen out of about 900, maybe 950. So somebody who had seen an electoral roll pointed out that
everybody voted in alphabetical order at the end of the day.
Yeah. You've read about this.
Yes.
And yet the Supreme Court intervened to stop the votes from being counted so that could come to light. You know, it's.
I just think it's odd, you know, that voter fraud is so prevalent, and I agree 100% that, you know, voter fraud is prevalent, and, you know, there are certain people that do not want the votes counted the way they were actually cast. That's why, you know, Diebold and all these other weird electronic voting machines.
Just terrifying. The possibility of hacking those systems just cries out for exposure. And the fact that...
hey, Gary, can you hold on one more segment?
Yeah.
All right. Sure. Thank you. We'll be back momentarily. This is Voluntary Values on the Liberty Radio Network with Daryl.
And Emberly.
And we have a guest on the line, Dr. Gary Chartier. He's involved with the Vote for Nobody campaign, and he's the author of Conscience of an Anarchist. But before we get back to Gary, I want to tell you about Annie's Homestead. AnniesHomestead.com is the place for handmade, vegan-friendly luxury soaps, Woo-hoo. Candles, lip balms, and more. One satisfied customer says, loving the soap. Creamy, gentle, and it smells beautiful. A soap any natural product connoisseur will absolutely love. During the month of September, all pure and natural soaps are 30% off. That's $1.50 off the regular price. When you order from annieshomestead.com, mention that you heard about it on Voluntary Values and that Daryl sent you, and Annie will give you a free lip balm. That's annieshomestead.com. So getting back to our guest, Gary Chartier, we promise this will be the last segment that we hold you over for. We know that you're a busy man. Gary,
it's really a pleasure to be here, Daryl. No apologies necessary.
Me and Emberly were talking about restrictive ballot access and yeah. how that was basically the final nail in the coffin for her as far as why she doesn't vote anymore. That and a documentary that she saw called Hacking Democracy.
Right. So a couple of years ago, when I was on my journey to becoming an anarchist, a friend of mine, you know, when I was arguing with him about why you should still, you know, should vote, he showed me this documentary called Hacking Democracy, which made me very emotional. And after that was the last nail in the coffin of my voting. I never voted again after watching that video, that documentary. It's really eye-opening about the whole system. So I encourage everyone out there, whether or not you vote or not, to watch this incredible video called Hacking Democracy. It's very, very good.
And during the last segment, towards the end, Gary, you were talking about the basically the stolen election in Texas, where Lyndon Johnson won by 87 votes. And there was the string of voters that all came in alphabetically. And that, of course, was just a coincidence.
Right. Yeah, just and then what was so striking to me about the story was the parallel with 2000, which Kimberly had mentioned,
right.
when what the Johnson campaign did was to say in court, Mr. Johnson will suffer irreparable harm if the votes are counted. And, if there's a recount, I mean, it was the same language that was used, by George Bush in Florida,
wow.
appealing to the Supreme Court, because the idea somehow is that if you've already been declared a winner, then to have that taken away from you because it turns out the votes you asserted you got, you didn't really get, well, that would just be too sad for words. It's just ridiculous. And, the story just highlighted for me how ripe the electoral system is for manipulation and abuse, and how the goal of frustrating any kind of transparency or accountability is so readily achieved by people with power.
Could I file a lawsuit saying that I have irreparable harm because there's really only two candidates that can win, and they both try to steal money from me?
I think you do suffer irreparable harm because of that, but somehow I'm betting that a way would be found to keep you from pursuing that suit very far. You didn't need me to tell you that. I want to just mention a couple of things while I'm still on the air, and I'm happy to take other questions or talk about other things. But I was just so pleased during the break that one of the ads that we got to hear was for the Libertopia Festival in San Diego, and that's something that I've been speaking at since it was initiated. I really want to encourage anybody who's able to make it out to San Diego, October 11 through 14, to do so. It's just an amazing experience, and it's really my favorite public event of every year. And so I really do encourage people to think seriously about Libertopia, with a great lineup of speakers and just marvelous people to interact with.
I wish I could go. I wish. But I just don't have the money.
I also would love to go to Libertopia. From what I hear, it's like Pork Fest at the beach.
Oh.
Pretty much. And just like I'd love to go to Pork Fest, I've been invited to come and speak in the past. And right now, there's just no practical way for me to get there because I'm just avoiding commercial air travel. It just raises my blood pressure too much.
Well, we're just going to have to figure out a way to get you to Pork Fest.
Teleporters,
that might work.
Teleporters, I'm all for it. as soon as you get that teleportation system working, you call me immediately and I'll be there.
But I have to agree with you that I don't like flying either. I don't like to fly, but two, I don't like the obtrusive nature of the TSA. And the last couple of times that I've flown since 9/11, which is four or five times since 9/11, I've been pulled out every single time. You know, to get the pat down every single time. So random.
They always give
the
pat downs to the pretty girls.
I don't think it has anything to do with, because it's not a man giving me a pat down. It's a woman. Every time it's been a woman.
Right. Well, that's the policy, but
don't you think
guys
the men would like
watching?
They want
that.
You to go through the backscatter machine so that they can see you with no clothes on.
Right.
That's the men. So I don't know. I don't know.
I have not flown
but thank
since
you for
the
that.
Backscatters
but,
were
but
put
thank
in.
You for that compliment, Daryl.
You know, I'm so with you, Daryl. I haven't flown since those machines were put in place, but really for me, the blood pressure started to go up way before that. You know, in particular with the attempt to seal off the gates from non-passengers, and once that started, it just made me so angry. And I just get more and more angry with the increasing imposition on passengers, as if the passengers
right.
were the enemy.
Well, one of the most disturbing things that ever happened to me at an airport was the first time that my child flew by himself. He was 10 years old. Okay. And I booked his flight through one of the major Delta was the airline that I booked his flight through. And I was a nervous wreck. You know, here's my 10-year-old son. He's just a little boy. He's my only child. You know, and they tell me that I can't see him to the gate. You know, that my child has to, you know, I can only go up to security with him.
Hold on.
And then he has to walk to the gate by himself at the Atlanta airport.
I can tell you for a fact that they were giving you incorrect information.
You're exactly right. Later on, when my mom picked him up, she got to go to the gate to pick him up.
I used to work for a subsidiary of Delta and unaccompanied minors.
You did not want to be the person that was on the phone. They answered the phone call that I made to Delta.
But you were also in Atlanta, and
yeah,
they're not the nicest people.
No, they're not. And that's a huge airport. And my little baby, you know, my only child is in this huge airport by himself. I was a nervous wreck. I was crying. And I've never flown with Delta since then because that really, really upset me. And I let them know. So I opted out of Delta. And I voted with my dollar and I don't spend money with them anymore. So that's a way to vote. You can vote with your money.
Yes. And Gary, I know in the book you advocate some solutions of basically, you know, like how to get to a free society. And one of the things that you advocate is through lawsuits against the state. And I forget exactly how you word it, but you do put in there, you know, that you don't normally advocate using government to fight government. I actually have a lawsuit against the city of Keene because two bureaucrats violated my right to privacy, and I was actually able to get the judge to recuse himself.
Nice. There's
good.
A win.
Good job.
Thank you so much, Gary, for joining us here on Voluntary Values.
Yes, we really appreciate it.
And give
Thanks
out
for having me, guys.
Your personal website.
Sure. So my website, my blog, is liberallaw, liberallaw.blogspot.com.
Wonderful.
But
welcome back to Voluntary Values. This is Daryl.
And this is Emberly.
And we have spent the last hour and 15 minutes talking to a wonderful guest, Gary Chartier. Gary's involved with the Vote for Nobody campaign, and he's the author of Conscience of an Anarchist. And while I do still cast ballots, and I do occasionally vote for ballot-listed candidates, I generally write in none of the above. So I do agree with Gary on a lot of things.
Yeah.
And as he said, you know, the decision whether or not to actually go take a ballot and write in nobody or vote for a ballot-listed candidate that you like, that's a personal decision. So
it is very personal. It's an incredibly personal decision, just like every decision that we make for our lives is incredibly personal.
Right.
So voting is not, you know, good or bad unless you deem it good or bad.
Right.
And that's for you to decide. And I'm a big advocate of individual freedom. You know, so what's right for me is not right for you, nor is it right for Mary Sue or even right for my son. Yeah,
right.
Just because he is not of the quote unquote legal age to decide for himself doesn't mean that he cannot decide for himself.
Right.
You know, what's right and what's wrong for him. And there are other ways, you know, so voting is one aspect of, you know, living without government, you know, in effect, having an anarchy society or a voluntary society, which is
right.
I call myself an anarchist, but I do prefer a voluntary society where
right.
we all work in cooperation together, you know, because I think that fosters a sense of community more than maybe anarchy does.
Right.
The word anarchy. You know, I love the word anarchy and I love calling myself an anarchist because, you know, it is, you know, without rulers, not without rules.
Right.
And most people, I think, get that distinction wrong. But there is a part of, you know, an anarchic voluntary society that undermines the state even more than not voting does. And that is the practice of agorism.
Yes.
And for those of you who are not familiar with what agorism is, we did discuss it a little bit last week because we had the first annual agorism day on Labor Day last week. And I actually launched my second agorist business that I have on agorism day, which is called Voluntary Services. And I thought that was the most appropriate thing for me to do for agorism day was to start my own agorist business. So basically how I like to talk about agorism is that it's working without, you're not doing anything illegal per se. So, but you're not working within the, you know, market system where you have to pay taxes, you know, or you're charging sales tax to your customers or any of those things. So it's kind of what I like to call the gray market. So you're not in the black market. So you're not doing anything illegal, but you're also not in the white market.
Well, you possibly could be doing things that are illegal.
Right. Technically by not paying taxes. Yes, that is technically considered illegal. But there are loopholes to that situation, too,
right,
built into the IRS code that, you know, there's a threshold of an amount of money that you can legally obtain without paying taxes on.
Right.
Now, I'm not exactly sure what that limit is.
Telling you that you
right. They're not going to come after.
Papers.
They're not going to come after you if you make whatever the limit is. And it changes year to year, I believe.
A couple $1,000s.
Right. It's not very much, but you know, it truly, you don't really need a lot of money to live. If you really look at your life and you know, decide what is it that you really, truly need versus what you want.
And then in the IRS distinction there, there's the receipts and then there's profit.
Right.
So your receipts, you could have $10,000 in receipts. But if your profit is below a certain percent, meaning that everything that you bring in, you either spend to, you know, expand the business
right.
or, you know, to pay rent for the business.
Right.
Business expenses such as, oh, I made a business trip and had to buy a mill.
Right.
So, you know, there is that
there's
sort
all kinds
of loophole.
Right. There's all kinds of loopholes in the system that are built into the system, you know, so that you can take advantage of those loopholes to have an agorist business.
Right.
Yeah. And I find having an agorist business to be, it's incredibly freeing, one, because you're not beholden to a boss. You know, you don't have a certain place you have to be at a certain time. You get to choose how much you want to work or how little you want to work, where you want to work. You know, what kind
right.
of clients you want to work for? Who do you want to give your business to? You know, what's the most important thing to you?
Right.
You know, and part of being, you know, when you start out an agorist business, it can be very difficult in the beginning. You know, this is my second one and my first one's really not going anywhere, but I'm actually not really promoting it that much because I'm kind of tired of that field of work anyway. I'm looking to expand and get out into some different markets that, so for me, this is a growth and an experimental phase for me to get out and try something different. I've been an administrative assistant for almost 20 years, and I'm tired of sitting behind a computer.
Right. Well,
and doing work like that.
Entrepreneurial venture, you know, there is going to be that growth, whether it's a, you know, quote unquote legitimate business
right.
or whether it's, you know, an agorist business. There is going to be that growth. And, you know, maybe you do get tired of doing whatever it is that you were doing. Or maybe it's not that you get tired of doing that, but you just want to do something different.
Right. And that's the lovely thing about having an agorist business is that you don't have to file all that nasty paperwork,
right,
you know, with the government. Because what if you decide, you know, that you're not going to, if you want to abandon that project, you don't have to go through, jump through all the hoops, you know, that the government makes you jump through to abandon that business,
right,
or, you know, so you can basically do what you want to. And it's very, very freeing. And I suggest that everyone at least think about it and try it.
And if you want more information on agorism, you can go to the website agorism.info.
Yeah, that's a great website.
And I have that pulled up, and I'm looking at the actual definition of agorism.
Great.
And agorism comes from the Greek word agora, meaning open marketplace. I'm sure people have heard the term agoraphobic. That's not somebody that's scared of agorist.
Right, right.
That's somebody that is scared of open places. And both come from the Greek word agora. And agorism is the ideology which asserts that the libertarian philosophical position occurs in the real-world practice, as in counter-economics. And counter-economics is defined as the study and or practice of all peaceful human action which is forbidden by the state.
Yes. That's exactly, you know, if you want to get away from the state and away from the system, then this is a great way to do it. You know, I think it's just, I want to see more agorist businesses, and there are a lot of websites that you can get registered on. Like the agorist marketplace, which we talked about last week.
Black and yellow
pages. Ron Helwig's.
Shire Silver.
You can become a merchant on his website, which I am currently. My business voluntary services is on there. I'm also listed on the black and yellow pages and the agorist marketplace. There's also one that's based strictly for New Hampshire, which is called the Shire Exchange.
I am not familiar with
which
that.
Which I have tried to, I have submitted my application to be on that website directory, but I have not heard back from them yet.
I need to contact them with information about free press publications.
So if you live in southern New Hampshire, anywhere from, you know, Concord to the, you know, state line with Massachusetts, you know, look me up on Facebook, you know, Emberly, McCullough, and look at my voluntary services, you know, page. You can also go to the voluntaryvalues.com website, and you'll find a link for that service there as well. You know, if you need any of those things done, you know, give me a call, drop me an email, let me know, and I'll give you a call back or drop you an email and let you know what I can do.
And if you need advertising or voiceover, I can do radio advertising, print advertising. There's actually a new monthly newspaper in New Hampshire.
Yes.
The FPP News. I'd been putting out a newsletter for 2 years, and just recently, on August 31st of this year, that into a newspaper, and that's currently being distributed around Keene. I have some copies up in Laconia, Concord, Peterborough, and other places. So if you want more info on that, go to news.fpp.cc. This is Voluntary Values, and this is the end of the show. That 2 hours went really fast.
Yes, it did. We'll see you again next week for the next episode of Voluntary Values. Peace and love.